British forces guarding the fortified border crossing used tear gas and water cannon to push them back.
You don't follow the orders.
That triggered some to throw stones at the border guards. The incident drawing this reaction from Moscow.
The behavior of the Polish side is completely unacceptable. I think the water cannons and tear gas and shots over the migrants' heads toward Belarus state, all of it reflects a desire to hide their own actions. And they cannot but understand that they violate all thinkable norms of the international humanitarian law and other international law norms.
The EU is accusing Belarus of engineering an unprecedented wave of migrants at Poland's border in revenge for the sanctions it's suffering from the bloc. Belarus, however, denies the allegations, accusing the EU of turning its back on the migrants and trying to shift the blame on Minsk to justify its new sanctions. Russia is backing Belarus in this dispute, with the Kremlin questioning the EU's double standards over the migrant crisis, warning that such approaches put the bloc in a bad position. The EU is now looking to widen the sanctions on Belarus, reacting to the news of the new sanctions. President Alexander Lukashenko said Belarus does not want confrontation with bloc over the migrant crisis. Lukashenko even initiated a phone call with German Chancellor Angela Merkel on Monday to discuss his proposal to end the crisis. Considering Belarus's earlier threat to shut down Russian gas supplies to Europe via pipelines that run through its territory, its latest reaction to the EU's fresh sanctions could be interpreted as a desire for de-escalation.
The Yellow Vests have marked their third anniversary, going from a ragtag group of gas tax protesters into a political force which has overturned decades of Western political norms. The defining image of the Emmanuel Macron era is undoubtedly the graffiti on the Arc de Triomphe, which read, "The Yellow Vests will triumph." That shocked the world, and then so did the once-in-a-century political repression which gutted France's claim of being a leader in free speech and political freedom. The numbers were staggering. At least 11,000 arrests, 1,000 political prisoners, 5,000 protesters seriously hurt, 1,000 critically injured, scores maimed for life, and 11 deaths. The Yellow Vests continue to redefine what citizen democracy is in the digital era by refusing to collude with the traditional hierarchies found in Western liberal democracies.
What we have done is provide a sort of national therapy. We made everybody, from politicians to unions to our institutions, fully aware of what a catastrophic situation France is in for the average person. 3 years ago, we took to the streets to demand economic justice, democratic justice, and ecological justice, and our movement has just begun.
Many ask what happened to the Yellow Vests, and the primary answer is that the massive state-sponsored violence and judicial intimidation, like the so-called anti-Yellow Vest law, scared the average person away from protesting. From June 2019 onwards, there seemed to be a blackout in French media on the Yellow Vests, as well as a massive censorship campaign on social media. After a year and a half pause due to the coronavirus, the Yellow Vests have marched every Saturday for over a month. They are expected to play a major role in France's presidential election in April. The Yellow Vests have proven themselves to be a new and entirely different type of political force. One which insists on inserting themselves into the political discourse, no matter how much some may try to ignore, silence, or repress. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
Saint-Pierre has always been one of the busiest hospitals in Brussels, but now it is busier than ever. In the 24 hours up to Wednesday, more than 12,000 new cases of coronavirus were recorded in Belgium and 41 deaths. Even at the doors of Saint-Pierre, it's easy to find people who are vaccine hesitant.
I feel concerned for my part, but I know people from my age feel concerned but aren't really good with the idea of getting vaccinated.
I don't need the vaccine because it's 2 years there is the coronavirus, but I I'm good. I'm very good. I'm not sick. I'm not, and my family's not sick.
COVID-19 cases and deaths are surging across the EU. In Italy, workers cannot physically attend to their jobs without a COVID pass. Experts suggest the country is doing better than neighbours because more children there have received the jab. In Austria, the unvaccinated have effectively been put into lockdown. Most venues in the Netherlands must close by 8 p.m. Hospitals in Ireland, Czech Republic, Bulgaria and Romania are struggling to cope.
So the message remains clear. Get vaccinated, maintain masks and social distance. Vaccination is necessary in our fight against this virus.
A fifth wave of the virus is hitting France, Germany and Belgium. Health experts say there is still a lot about the crisis that is not understood. For example, it is not known why the vaccines do not work on 10% of people who take them. It is not clearly known for how long the vaccines remain effective. What is known, however, is that people who are vaccinated are far less likely to end up in hospital. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
For the fourth time, the Israeli High Court has rejected an appeal made to release Kaid El-Fesfous, a Palestinian prisoner whom his health condition is seriously deteriorating due to his open-ended hunger strike that he started 125 days ago. El-Fesfous is protesting his imprisonment under Israel's administrative detention without charge or trial. The Commission of Detainees and Ex-Detainees Affairs, who made the appeal, says El-Fesfous could be minutes away from sudden death, especially after doctors at the Berzelay Medical Center, where he's being hospitalized, said diagnosis showed he developed blood clots.
It's obvious that Israeli authorities want to adopt a new approach in dealing with the hunger strikes against administrative detention. They are exerting force at the utmost. Even if Al-Fesfous or other hunger striking prisoners die, they don't care. Maybe they think this way they will be unfolding this file. We are continuing our efforts and we really hope Al-Fesfous won't die because the repercussions will be out of control inside the jails and outside it.
In addition to Kaid El-Fesfous, four other prisoners have been refusing to eat, also to protest the illegal Israeli policy of administrative detention. They are all demanding the occupying regime to either release them or prosecute them. Weekly protests continue to take place in solidarity with the hunger-striking prisoners. Palestinians, including prisoners' families and relatives, have protested outside the building of the International Committee of the Red Cross in Ramallah.
Despite repeated warnings about the hunger strikers' deteriorating health conditions, Israel has always been defiant in dealing with their legal demands to make sure that no more prisoners follows the same path in the future.
The Israeli occupation does not know the meaning of humanity. Literally, those prisoners are dying. They must immediately be released. Their detention is illegal in the first place.
Over the years, Israel has placed thousands of Palestinians in administrative detention for prolonged periods of time without charge or trial, claiming they were arrested based on secret reports, which are inaccessible to prisoners themselves and their lawyers. Today, Israel holds over 4,600 Palestinian prisoners in its jails, with some 500 of them under the illegal administrative detention. Prisoners' advocacy groups say the only request of Kaid El-Fesfous and other Palestinian hunger-striking prisoners is their freedom and an end to their arbitrary administrative detention. After 125 days of an open-ended hunger strike against Israel's illegal policy, El-Fesfous' family says he would be victorious either through his long-awaited release or martyrdom. Mona Kandil, occupied Ramallah.
Palatica factions in the Gaza Strip, along with the Joint Committee for Refugees, gathered in front of the UNRWA office in the Gaza Strip to reject the framework agreement signed between the United States and the agency regarding the restoration of U.S. funding for the UNRWA. The demonstration comes in conjunction with the International Conference for UNRWA, where several donor countries are scheduled to convene in Brussels under the chairmanship of Jordan and Sweden to discuss resuming the financial support to the UN agency and the Palestinian Authority.
بالتزامن مع انعقاد مؤتمر المانحين
We are holding this press conference based on our Palestinian people's demands all over the world. At the same time, the International Conference for UNRWA is being held in Brussels. UNRWA has been suffering from a critical impasse, and the victims of this shortage of aid are the poor Palestinian refugees. We are all united in expressing that we won't give up our right of return, and we have been calling for this right for 73 years. The international community is now in front of the real test whether to be committed to its conventions or not.
The framework for cooperation between the UNRWA and the U.S. for 2021-2022 calls for restoring U.S. funding to the UN agency after it was cut off for several years under former U.S. President Donald Trump. It includes that the U.S. will not make any contributions to UNRWA except on the condition that UNRWA ensures that no part of the U.S. contribution is used to assist any refugee receiving military training as a member of the Palestinian Liberation Organizations.
We are calling the donor countries to support the issue of Palestinian refugees that was founded basically by U.S. UNRWA has been the only witness for all the violations of Palestinians' rights, and the international community should maintain a long-term and sustainable fund to support Palestinian refugees until they gain their freedom. This is a systematic conspiracy to demolish the issue of Palestinian refugees.
UNRWA provides services, especially in health and education, for more than 5.5 million Palestinian refugees. Palestinians say that UNRWA must remain committed to its duties until their right of return is guaranteed. Ruba Shavit, Gaza.
This is IRIB English Radio.
Get up. Good morning.
Good morning. Your captain speaking, and we are currently cruising over Iranian sky.
راه شهید بهشتی مسافرین گرامی خواهشمند از جهت تعیین مسیر به تابلوهای راهنما توجه فرمایید.
Hello, good morning.
Good morning. How is everything?
Good morning, Mom.
Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Thank you.
the supplication on Sundays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. In the name of Allah, from whom I hope for nothing but bounty, and from whom I fear nothing but justice. I rely only upon His word, and I cling only to His cord. In Thee I seek sanctuary, O possessor of pardon and good pleasure. From wrong and enmity, and from the changes of time, and the recurrence of sorrows, and from the striking of mishaps, and from the expiration of my term before preparation and readiness. From Thee I seek guidance to that wherein is righteousness and being set right. From Thee I seek help in that which is linked to success and favorable response. Thee I beseech for the garment of well-being and its completion, and for the covering of health and its permanence. I seek refuge in Thee, my Lord, from the goadings of the Satans. And I seek protection in Thy sovereignty from the injustice of the sovereigns. So accept my past prayers and fasting, and make my tomorrow and what is after better than my present hour and my today. And exalt me in my clan and my people, and protect me in my waking and my sleeping. For Thou art Allah, the best guardian, and Thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, I am quit before Thee on this day of mine and on all Sundays that follow it, of associating others with Thee and of heresy. And I devote my supplication sincerely to Thee, addressing myself to Thy response. And I observe the acts of obedience to You for the hope of Your rewards. So, bless Muhammad, the best of Thy creation, the summoner to Thy truth. Exalt me with Thy exaltation, which is never made to suffer loss. And protect me with Thy eye, which never sleeps. And seal my affair by cutting me off from everything but Thee and my life with forgiveness. Surely, Thou art the all-forgiving, the all-compassionate.
Bring us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of internet.
The Spotlight.
Welcome to Spotlight. Iran condemns the latest U.S. sanctions targeting several Iranian nationals and one entity, saying the measures are illegitimate and baseless. The United States on Thursday imposed new sanctions against Iran, accusing it of interfering in the 2020 presidential election. Iran's foreign ministry spokesman says the new sanctions are the continuation of the failed maximum pressure policy adopted by the previous U.S. administration. Saeed Khatibzadeh says that the U.S. has a long history of meddling in other countries' affairs and is playing a blame game to deceive the American public. Now, as a new round of talks with the P4+1 group is scheduled to start at the end of this month, U.S. measures are indicative of the fact that it is not sincere about Washington's return to the JCPOA, regardless of the fact which party is in the Oval Office.
As the clock is ticking for a new round of talks between Iran and the remaining signatories to the 2015 nuclear deal, Washington is showing more signs of unwillingness to settle disagreements despite earlier comments made by U.S. officials. On Thursday, Washington announced new sanctions on six Iranian nationals and one entity, accusing them of intimidating and influencing American voters during last year's presidential election. Iran's foreign ministry condemned the new sanctions as illegitimate and baseless. It said the new bans are a continuation of the failed maximum pressure policy adopted by the previous U.S. administration. Tehran also highlighted Washington's long history of meddling in other countries' internal affairs and playing a blame game to deceive the American public. Analysts say there is no evidence of any interference by Iran in the U.S.'s 2020 presidential race.
There's no evidence whatsoever that Iran or Russia had any meddling, any interference with American elections. The only meddlers in the election was really the Democrat Party and the Mossad and the Israeli intelligence operations and the CIA. They've been perfecting these programs for over 15 years, and they've undermined the elections in other countries, such as Ukraine and Venezuela, and that was admitted to by people like John McCain and John Bolton and Barack Obama and Mitt Romney. These elections in America have been farces and completely manipulated by the technology that the U.S. developed for influencing and corrupting other elections. But they are attempting to constantly brand Iran as a threat to the United States and trying to whip up frenzy in the American people.
U.S. President Joe Biden and his Democratic Party repeatedly criticized Donald Trump during his term for his way of dealing with Iran and withdrawing from the 2015 nuclear agreement. But ironically, since he came to power, Biden persisted in his predecessor's so-called maximum pressure campaign against Iran and even imposed more sanctions against the Islamic Republic. This is why U.S. media and officials have admitted that the campaign against Iran has failed. Tehran held several rounds of talks with the FIPOR Plus One group between April and June with the aim of removing the sanctions, but no breakthrough was reached. Now, as the new round of talks scheduled to start on November 29th draws nearer, the U.S. measures against Iran further question Washington's sincerity about the issue, regardless of which party is at the helm in the White House.
Well, joining us on this edition of Spotlight, we have activist from the Answer Coalition, Richard Becker, joining us from San Francisco. And also we have journalist and author Daniel Azar joining us from New York.
Is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Well, gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Mr. Becker in San Francisco. Mr. Becker, Iran has condemned the latest U.S. sanctions, saying that the bans are the continuation of the failed maximum pressure policy adopted by the previous administration, meaning the Donald Trump administration. Is that what's going on here, in your opinion?
Yeah, I think so. The basis given for the latest sanctions is just ludicrous. The idea that Iran was intimidating voters in the United States, that's the first time I heard that one. That's really creative. on the part of those in the State Department and the National Security Council to come up with things like this. I mean, the whole representation of reality that is presented here is that Iran is threatening the United States, and Iran poses an ongoing danger to the United States. But it's not Iran, Iranian aircraft carriers and submarines sitting off the coast of New York or San Francisco, the way that the U.S. military is deployed, and particularly naval and air power is deployed surrounding Iran. And so I say this because this is the misrepresentation to the people of the United States that somehow Iran poses a grave danger, or Venezuela does, or Cuba does, or China does. And all of this is presented to the people here in order to justify this vast military network, the U.S. military network around the world. But again, as we said in the lead, we see the Biden administration essentially carrying out the maximum pressure campaign, which really has the effect of doing the greatest damage to the most vulnerable members of society. This is always who these kind of sanctions really impact, and that's the poor people, the working people, the farmers, the people who are deprived of the necessities of life. And at the same time, the intention is to weaken the country as a whole.
Daniel Azar, Washington accused those targeted by the sanctions of trying to influence America's 2020 presidential election. A guest that we spoke to actually here earlier on Press TV said that accusation appears to be part of efforts to brand Iran as a threat to America. How do you feel about these accusations?
Well, I mean, in this particular incident, I mean, we should be completely skeptical. I mean, the U.S. concept, the understanding of what foreign interference means, it was the charges that made against Russia in 2016 were ludicrous. A Russian company had placed $44,000 worth of ads on Facebook, some of which seemed to be anti-Hillary Clinton and pro-Donald Trump, and the U.S. authorities built that very minor incident with no proven relationship to the Russian government itself into a giant cause célèbre that dominated American news for 3 years. So we've got to be maximally skeptical of these charges. But that said, I mean, the U.S. thinks nothing of doing the same thing to other countries, of using social media, various kinds of monetary investments, et cetera, in order to foment subversive movements in countries it doesn't like, such as Nicaragua, Venezuela, Cuba, et cetera. So it has no compunctions about engaging in these activities itself. So when Iran engages in what, at the very most, is a minor intervention in the U.S., and I'm giving the U.S. too much credit and even describing it that way, we've just got to take it all with a huge grain of salt. And the U.S. has stepped up pressure on Iran. Joe Biden's policies are indistinguishable from those of Donald Trump. In fact, if anything, they're even more aggressive. And the U.S. is obviously conducting a siege on Iran, which I think at some point could lead to a military confrontation.
Richard Becker, analysts say so far that this is the reaction that we've been seeing, that there's no evidence yet of any interference by Iran in the U.S. 2020 election. What does Iran actually have to gain from swaying the U.S. elections? Democrat or Republican, Washington has always maintained this enmity towards Iran since the inception of the Islamic Revolution. This makes these accusations even more questionable.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, no one that I know of before this has hinted that there was some interference by Iran in the U.S. election. I mean, it's just so ridiculous. It's just such a ridiculous charge. And I think really what these The Security Council, National Security Council, or the State Department, or whoever is working, whose desks are assigned to this, to the Iran job, are doing is that they find something that they say, well, that this ad may have come from Russia or may have come from Iran, as if it's the government doing it. I mean, most of that stuff, I think, has been quite convincingly in the case of Russia, because this is the first time we've heard about the allegations regarding Iran. But the ones coming from Russia was that there were people who were playing both sides of the fence in some cases, and the interpretation given by the government here was, well, they're trying to confuse people. I mean, there's already enough polarization in society that don't need the Iranians or the Russians to prompt more polarization. But it was probably really fundraising. It's probably really like this kind of low-level fundraising, but it gets fit into what the outlook is at the governmental level, at the highest level, and wanting to step up the hostility toward Iran, wanting to impose new penalties, new punishments on Iran, and they're doing the same thing in regard to Cuba, where Trump put in 243 new sanctions policies. Biden discontinued them all. So we have this continuation, whether it's the Democrats or the Republicans in the White House, of this policy of maximum pressure, seeking to bring about regime change in countries that pose no threat to the United States, but simply wish to go their own way in the world. In other words, to use their own resources for the benefit of their own people and not be subject to the dictates and the whims of Washington.
Daniel Zahn, let's talk about the timing of these sanctions. As we know, the Vienna talks are set to restart in about 10 days. Despite earlier comments made by U.S. officials, U.S. is showing more signs of unwillingness to settle any of these disagreements. What is Washington trying to achieve with this type of behavior?
I think it's trying to ingratiate itself with Israel. I think it's trying to reassure Saudi Arabia that it's on its side. And I think it's trying to reestablish its credibility in the Persian Gulf following the chaotic Afghan retreat in August. So I think the U.S. is trying to puff itself up, to show it's still in control, to show it's still a tough guy, that it can push Iran around as much as it sees fit. But these policies, I think this really just serves and they're so ridiculous. And U.S. credibility is so thoroughly shot that they sort of just wind up underscoring America's growing helplessness in this part of the world.
Richard Becker, we were talking about the timing. Tehran says that its goal of participating in the upcoming Vienna talks with the remaining signatories to the nuclear deal is not about the nuclear deal, actually, but about removal of anti-Iran sanctions. That does seem like a fair assessment, given that the nuclear deal has already been negotiated. What do you think about Tehran's stance in this regard?
Well, I think that anyone who looks at it from a common sense, logical point of view, as is often said, would have to agree with Iran, and Iran's position on this. They negotiated a deal. It was a long, difficult process. Those negotiations were carried out leading up to the 2015 agreement with the sword hanging over Iran's neck of sanctions. The sanctions were already imposed. It was only to get rid of the sanctions, to get the sanctions lifted, that Iran agreed to enter into talks with countries, a number of countries that had nuclear weapons and were insisting, no, Iran can't develop even peaceful nuclear development, as Iran said it was doing. So it was a very unjust, it was a very onerous process that went on. And then an agreement was reached. But as soon as the agreement was reached, the partners in the agreement, and by that I mean particularly the members of the European members of the Security Council and Germany, were going very slow because they were fearful that sanctions would be reimposed with a change in administration, and that they would be that would cause them problems. So they went very slow. Then Trump pulls out of the deal, and then those same partners appeal to Iran and say, "No, no, don't pull out. Stay in the deal. We will ameliorate the sanctions, the impact of the sanctions on you." And they didn't. They didn't do anything. It's a combination of fear of U.S. power, financial power in this case in particular, to levy enormous fines, and also that they have, ever since World War II, really been part of, and by far the junior partners, in the U.S. military alliance in the world.
Daniel Azar, U.S. measures at this point, they're proving more and more that it's not sincere about the whole issue, regardless of, as we mentioned in our lead-in to the show, which person or party is in power in the White House. At this point, why should Iran even trust the U.S. altogether?
Well, you know, it's really pretty remarkable. You know, the Biden, the Obama administration, which included Joe Biden, who was vice president at the time, negotiated this this treaty. They were willing to buck pressure from Saudi Arabia and Israel. They took various measures to appease both nations, but at least they sort of showed a certain willingness to stand up to pressure from Riyadh and Jerusalem. But since then, but that was in 2015. In the 6 years since, the U.S. posture has weakened, so that the U.S. is unable to chart an independent policy vis-a-vis Israel and Saudi Arabia. It's actually more at the mercy of those two countries than it was before. So therefore, you know, Joe Biden, after taking part in negotiations in 2015, and then slamming Trump and withdrawing from the treaty unilaterally in 2018, now was unable to follow up by re-entering the treaty, because he's afraid of what Israel will say, what Saudi Arabia will say, and what their allies on Capitol Hill will say. So all the U.S. does is show how weak and really helpless it is. And as to Iran, I mean, I agree. I think Iran must realize at this point that the U.S. really will never go re-enter that treaty under terms remotely acceptable to Tehran. So I think that that Iran is playing a waiting game. It has no reason to withdraw from the negotiations. So it's kind of playing things out and meanwhile trying to strike alliances with other countries, most notably China and Russia. So Iran is improving its position while I think the U.S. Is just showing greater and greater weakness.
Okay, one last question that I'm going to address to both of our guests tonight. Richard Becker, who benefits from this state of limbo, from this uncertainty regarding the Iran nuclear deal?
Well, I have to say, the U.S. is the center of the most far-flung empire that has ever existed. I don't think any constituent part of that empire, and Israel and Saudi Arabia are both subordinate elements in it, that they control U.S. foreign policy. I don't think that's true, and I don't think that's logical. But it is... the U.S. empire is weakening. It's a weakening empire, and particularly in the Middle East, South Asia, you can see this. You have particularly because of the withdrawal from Afghanistan and the way that it was carried out, but just the defeats that the U.S. has suffered in the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. And if you can't win, you lost, and that's the reality. So I think that they're trying to bolster their position in that part of the world, in the Middle East, while at the same time, the U.S. is carrying out the pivot to Asia and preparations for war with China.
Same question to Daniel Azar before we wrap up the show. Who benefits from this limbo, this uncertainty regarding the JCPOA?
I'm not really sure if anybody benefits. I mean, I think what's happening is that both all sides are preparing for a greater conflict. I think that Israel has been threatening war against Iran for years, but I think the chances of a confrontation are going up. And I think if that happens, the U.S. will have no choice but to line up in support behind Israel. I think that the someone once said that that peace is that moment of opportunity when everybody takes the when everybody reloads their guns. So I think that that all sides are preparing for some kind of further confrontation down the road.
All right, thanks a lot, gentlemen. Activists at the Answer Coalition, Richard Becker, joining us from San Francisco, and journalist and author Danny Lazar speaking to us from New York. Thank you for contributing to Spotlight. And also, I have to thank our guests for staying with us on show. It's a good night for now.
Iranian Radio. Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The limelight. European citizens who have applied for settled status in Britain are being detained and threatened with deportation, a development that contradicts assurances from UK ministers and appears to contravene the Brexit withdrawal agreement. We'll prepare for you an article written by Lisa O'Carroll. The piece is titled Brexit Rules Force Families to Split. The article has been published by the British newspaper The Guardian. A British woman has told how she had to separate her six-year-old son from his French father because post-Brexit rules prohibited her spouse from returning with her to the United Kingdom for a new job without prior Home Office approval. After 11 years in France, the couple, who work in highly skilled jobs in the defence industry, decided to move back to the United Kingdom and thought it would be as simple as getting on a Eurostar train. However, the Home Office no longer recognises the European Union family permit her husband used before Brexit, and is now taking months to respond to applications for a British version. The delays are splitting countless families, whereby one British parent can return to the United Kingdom and a non-British one, whether an EU citizen or from elsewhere, cannot. The woman explained how she had little choice but to make the journey with her six-year-old son because her new job started on 6th of September, and although she was expecting a family permit for her husband within 15 days, 2 months after her application, she is still waiting for a Home Office response. She was so anxious that her dual national son might be refused entry because he has yet to get his British passport that she went so far as drilling him to say he was going on holiday if questioned by immigration officials. She sent her luggage on separately to make it look like she was not moving country. She said, "I was so scared that they would say, 'It seems to me like you are moving. No, sorry, your son cannot come,'" adding, "My husband stayed driving around Gare du Nord station in Paris just in case." She said, "I got so paranoid that I sent my baggage ahead on a service run by Eurostar and bought a return ticket because I had read that border officials were refusing people if they suspected your intention was to stay in Britain. It was so stressful, so awful, because we were afraid my son was going to be turned away." She added, "To be honest, it's very hard on my son. We tried to make light of it, just saying we're going on vacation, but he misses his father. Now he's saying, 'I miss my dad. When can we see dad?'" She also feels bad for her husband, who also quit his job in anticipation of the move back to London. An aeronautical operations manager in the defense industry, he is now unemployed and may not be able to accept a new post in the United Kingdom while his application for a family permit is in progress. Non-EU and now non-British spouses have to rely on a 1992 EU legal precedent known as the Surinder Singh route to live in the United Kingdom. The government pledged that anyone returning to the United Kingdom from the European Union who was exercising their free movement rights could come back with a foreign spouse under this precedent. However, before a spouse can make his application to remain in the country, he must first be issued with a family permit. Alexander Finch, a manager at immigration specialist law firm Fragoman, said, "Overall, the European Union settlement scheme has worked well for many Europeans, but it's a shame that it is taking a very long time for Surinder Singh applicants. The withdrawal agreement requires the United Kingdom to deal with family permit applications on the basis of an accelerated procedure, which is not happening." He added that the United Kingdom is also going beyond previous requirements to prove that the place of residence was genuinely the European Union. He noted it doesn't help that the Home Office chose to go beyond the requirements of European Union law and has ended up with a confusing definition of genuine residence. According to government information, with reports of the Home Office in some cases taking 6 months to issue permits that are supposed to take just 15 days, Smith and her husband have joined a mounting number of parents facing potential splits. One young Briton in Portugal who is married to a Brazilian has told how she fears the delays in seeking a family permit could force her to temporarily leave her two-month-old baby with his father while she returns home to Bristol to get their four-year-old in school and start a new life. A Home Office spokesperson said, "Applications for the European Union settled status family permits are considered in strict date of application order, and we continue to review staffing levels and deploy resources to areas of greatest need. Each case is considered as quickly as possible and on its individual merits, but processing times can vary depending on the volume and complexity of applications. The 15-day service standard does not apply to all entry clearance applications. Meanwhile, European citizens who have applied for settled status are being detained and threatened with deportation, a development that contradicts assurances from UK ministers and appears to contravene the Brexit withdrawal agreement. The Home Office has served European Union nationals with removal directions even though they could prove they had applied for settled status, which should protect their rights to remain in the United Kingdom. Ministers have repeatedly promised that anyone who had applied by the 30th of June deadline would have their existing rights protected while their case was being heard. The apparent failure to honour that agreement has prompted accusations of either administrative incompetence by Home Office officials or a willful attempt to deport as many European Union nationals as possible on the assumption they're easier to remove, for instance, than asylum seekers. A letter from the legal charity Bail for Immigration Detainees to the head of the Immigration Enforcement raises concerns over the Home Office's failure to acknowledge receipt of settled status applications in cases where it wants to deport European Union citizens. Bail for Immigration Detainees says that unless a response is received from the Home Office by the end of this week, it will make an official complaint to the European Commission. Lawyers argue it marks an important battle to protect the rights of European Union nationals following Brexit. They warn that the failure to acknowledge applications could potentially affect thousands of individuals. Recently, an EU citizen whom the Home Office wanted to deport and who had been detained in an immigration removal centre secured their release on bail after a judge accepted that they could not be removed because they had made a European Union settled status application. Even so, the Home Office still contested their release and offered no apology or explanation why it had earlier argued there was no evidence of the application at a previous hearing and therefore could deport them. Speaking shortly after being released, the EU national, who requested anonymity, told The Observer, "They're trying to play with mine and my family's lives, and it's not fair. I'm supposed to have rights." Pierre McClough, legal director of Bail for Immigration Detainees, said, "It seems that Home Office has pre-decided the fate of certain EU nationals, perhaps believing that they're easy to remove. But in its drive to deport more people, it is sidestepping legal requirements and legal procedures." Pierre McClough added, "Whether this is due to administrative or willful neglect may be unclear, but by ignoring the legal steps the EU nationals have undertaken to assert their rights, the United Kingdom is in breach of its duties under the Brexit withdrawal agreement." The issue appears to relate mostly to applicants sent by post instead of forwarded digitally. Aranya Kogulathos, a barrister and legal manager of BID's European Economic Area project, said paper applications were used by many vulnerable and marginalized people, including the elderly and those in detention or prison, who found it difficult to access a computer or didn't have access to a valid identity document. The numbers affected could be significant. For instance, out of 1,500 prison inmates at Wandsworth Prison, South London, almost 500 are believed to be EU nationals. Kogulatha said, despite having made European Union settled status applications, the European Economic Area nationals are being deprived of their liberty and even served with removal directions, both of which they are forced to challenge despite limited access to legal advice and legal representation.
heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.